From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, how intestinal microbes influence our health. Also, a memoir about life with a white father who tried hard to be black. And indie pop musician Jules B, a.k.a. Sea of Bees, with a song from her new album. First, more than 700 workers will soon lose their jobs because of Sacramento County's continuing budget problems. Yesterday, the Board of Supervisors finalized their spending plan for the coming fiscal year. Along with the layoffs, Sacramento County will trim or eliminate programs and services across the board. Joining us to talk about all this are two members of the Sacramento County Board of Supervisors, Roberta McGlashan, who is vice chair of the board and represents District 4, the northeastern part of the county, and Don Natoli, who represents District 5, the eastern and southern part of the county. Supervisors, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Let's start with how you decided what to cut. Let's start with you, Supervisor Roberta McGlashan. How did you decide what should be cut?
Well, I was looking more at what needed to be saved, and my focus is and always has been on public safety first.
And so as a result, anything that did not come under that umbrella could be cut?
Needed to be cut.
Okay. And Supervisor Don Natoli, what was your overriding philosophy about deciding what to cut and what not to cut?
Well, it was, without question, very, very difficult, and I would certainly join my colleague that public safety and public protection were, you know, the top priorities, and I think where we had the most difficult part of the process was that we knew we were going to have to make reductions, significant reductions, on the order of magnitude of $100 million or more, and that it was going to result in layoffs as well as, obviously, cuts in lots of different programs, and even with the restorations that were made with the board's action yesterday, which put money back in to law enforcement and the district attorney and probation, we still fell very, very, very short. But there were significant cuts, and we can talk about those in a moment.
Well, before we get to the cuts, I want to first of all talk about how money was freed up this week, if that's the right phrase. As I understand, you started the week facing a $122 million deficit, but as the week went on, you cut that to just under $100 million, which freed up or created about $23 million to put back into the budget. I'm curious to know where that money came from. Roberta McGlashan?
Yes. Well, the largest share of it came from loans we had made to ourselves, internal loans from other funds a year and a half ago, and we decided to defer the repayment of those loans for another year.
And Don Natoli, where else did this money come from?
Yeah, I would add to that we also saw some improvement in the projections for, in particular, the sales tax, both the year-end as well as the projections for next year. Again, still staying on the conservative side because we've seen a number of quarters where that has been significantly off of not only some of the levels of a couple of years ago, but also of projections. And so that improved it by about $5 million. And then there were some other savings and some financing that related to debt service on a couple of the facilities in the county that we were able to use capital construction fund monies for this year's debt payment. But again, ongoing, that would put us in a position of deferring the projects that are very needed in years to come. So that was those are, you know, temporary moves. But all in all, we got to the number that you mentioned.
We're talking about Sacramento County's budget. Over 700 county workers are going to be laid off. Many programs are being cut or at least trimmed. Almost all of the money that was created this week to be put back into the budget went into public safety departments of one kind or another. About $500,000 went to other places. Supervisor Don Natoli, how did you decide where that remaining $500,000 was going to go?
Well, there was a list that was many, many millions of dollars. In fact, there were some of the things that were on the list for discussion that we, did, very frankly, at the end of the session yesterday, didn't even get to because I think it was clear that the majority of the board, even though it fell short in the eyes of some and certainly fell short, with regards to the amount that was needed to sustain some very vital services in public protection and law enforcement, that whatever we had freed up, that needed to go predominantly to the sheriff, the district attorney, and probation, and the remaining portion went to a few items to save a few public health nurse positions, the children's receiving home, and veteran services office. Beyond that, we still cut park rangers, animal care, CPS, adult protective services, child protective services, and the list went on and on and on, and it totaled well over 700 people to be laid off.
Well, Roberta McGlashan, many of those cuts that Don Natoli just mentioned, CPS, Child Protective Services, the Boys Ranch Juvenile Detention Center, the Rangers and the American River Parkway, animal care, these are all variations on public safety. Why did you decide that, since public safety was your top priority, as you say, why did you decide that cuts were okay there but not in some other public safety departments?
Because the board has an adopted set of priorities, and our top priority is discretionary law enforcement. So my biggest concern was with the sheriff's department, and that the proposed cuts were going to essentially eliminate all patrol services in the unincorporated area. And I just can't fathom a community that doesn't have sheriff's deputies to respond to calls. And even with the amount of money we were able to restore, I don't know yet where we end up, and I fear that we are still going to fall very short in that area.
Don Natoli, when you look at the budget as it now is there anything you look at and particularly regret, not personally, but just as a group?
Well, I share Roberta's concern. I think the board does as a whole relative to, you know, we still don't know how this is going to sort out as it relates to reductions that were taken, certainly in the sheriff's department or probation. But I think we have a good idea of, for example, closure of the Boys Ranch. That facility had been, established some 50-plus years ago, and loss of field nursing that had been around for some 80 years. And the impacts to people overall, and I think, you know, in my view, certainly it's you know, very regrettable that not only with the reductions that were made, but I think the fact that we know that there's going to be greater risk in lots of different segments of our community because of some of the things that we took action on yesterday, and that's certainly very troublesome.
The vote yesterday on the budget was 3-2. The two votes against the budget were Roberta McGlashan, one of our guests, and Roger Dickinson, who's not with us and who's an outgoing member of the Board of Supervisors. He's in a tight race for the Democratic nomination for the one seat in the State Assembly. Roberta McGlashan, why did you vote against the budget?
Well, it was not something I did lightly. As I said yesterday, I have been an elected official for 14 years now. This is the first time I have ever voted no on a budget. And I did that because I believe that we could have restored more funding to the sheriff's department, and a majority of the board was not willing to do that.
Don Natoli, what do you say to that perspective?
Well, and again, I certainly respect my colleagues, both of them, their position on this, and I said so yesterday. I think that in the budget, when we are asked to balance a budget, it's not just with numbers. It's obviously with all the various service demands and program elements and all the things that are embedded in that. And in my view, there were certainly lots and lots of things that you could not like about the budget, and certainly, you know, even have some second thoughts about that, and I mentioned that as well. But overall, we have a fiduciary responsibility to bring in a balanced budget. We certainly have a responsibility to the people of the county in providing services and seeing to their safety and welfare in those areas that we administer programs. But in my view, we needed to get to a decision, and we'll certainly have plenty of time in the weeks ahead to try to continue to sort through this. But I believe that we needed to go forward yesterday in light of obviously. Yeah. The work that we had done on this.
Well, as I said, the other vote against the budget was Roger Dickinson. Let's listen to a clip of him talking yesterday.
This budget, in my estimation, tells those who are the most vulnerable in our community, the young, the old, the sick, the poor, that they are the forgotten, overlooked, and continue to have no presence of any significance before this board.
Well, clearly, Roger Dickinson has a very different perspective from you, Roberta McGlashan, on the budget about the priorities, but you both came to the same ultimate conclusion, which was to vote against it. But I'm guessing that no one, whether supervisor or staff, liked very much about this budget. Why not just vote for it and move forward?
Because there's time when you need to take a stand. And yes, Supervisor Dickinson and I voted no, but for very different reasons. We still spend hundreds of millions of dollars addressing the needs of the poor and the ill and the vulnerable and children. It's not like we're not spending money on that as well. But I believe that we need to have a community that's safe so that people will continue to want to live here and invest in businesses here and to have a thriving community.
It seems to me that there are at least a couple of variables still here. One is the state budget, which is a long way, presumably, from being passed. And whatever happens with the state budget could have a big impact on the county budget. Don Natoli, could you tell us how that stands?
Yes, no, I concur with that, and that, you know, that's part of, I think, what we're going to have to watch very closely, and certainly we'll be engaged in those discussions as appropriate to over the course of the summer. But particularly in the area of human services, we can, you know, find significant, you know, impacts by what either happens or doesn't happen in the legislative process at the Capitol. And we know there, hopefully, with the prospects that, you know, we're going to see some improvement, you know, in the economy over the, you know, next year or two, that'll, you know, present some hope. But we need to, you know, keep our eye on what's going to happen next, you know, down the street a few blocks, because it can have a severe impact. And when we come back in September, we'll have to weigh that in our final budget deliberations at that time.
And I guess another variable is union contracts. As I understand, negotiations are continuing with unions. Roberta McGlashan, is the Board of Supervisors expecting some financial relief from the unions?
Well, I would say we're very hopeful that we will get some relief through contract extensions and concessions. We, our labor negotiators are continuing to meet and talk with their representatives, and the way we structured the budget yesterday, if concessions come in before the layoffs are final, those can be rescinded.
So, Don Natoli, that means that if the county does not get concessions from the unions, that the budget could get worse?
Well, it certainly, from the standpoint of what we approved yesterday or took action on yesterday, anything that was in there, it was, you know, relative to negotiations, concessions, was there. Actually, part of some of the money that was freed up was a anticipated agreement with one of the labor organizations. And very frankly, last year, a couple of the organizations helped to save jobs last year. But if there are no additional concessions forthcoming, then I think what we approved yesterday will be pretty close to what rolls out over the course of the next few weeks relative to layoffs and loss of positions.
Okay, well, thank you both so much. That's Don Natoli, also Roberta McGlashan. They're both Sacramento County Supervisors. We've been talking about the fiscal year budget about to come. The supervisors approved a budget yesterday. Hundreds of jobs will be lost. Roberta McGlashan, Don Natoli, thanks you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a memoir about life with a white father who tried hard to embrace black culture. To Insight from Capital Public Radio, I'm Jeffrey Callison. Email us suggestions to insight@capradio.org. Today on Talk of the Nation Science Friday, plastic man-made antibodies that have been shown to work in mice. Plus, you'll hear from an Alaskan reporter who covered the Exxon Valdez spill 21 years ago, and the history and future of airships like blimps and zeppelins. That's Science Friday after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. I'm Down is a memoir of an unusual childhood. Mishna Wolf was raised in an inner-city Seattle neighborhood by a white father who lived his life as if he was black. Why did John Wolf do that? What impact did it have on his daughter? Mishna Wolf is in town with her book. Mishna Wolf, welcome to Inside.
Hi, how are you?
Well, I'm fine. Why did your father decide to dress and act the way he did?
Well, I mean, I think he grew up after civil rights. He was very involved as a teenager in sort of the Panthers. He helped out with the breakfast program, and he was an athlete. So a lot of his friends were, you know, other black athletes. And he moved into a neighborhood that when he moved there, or when his parents moved there, I should say, it was a predominantly white and Asian neighborhood. It was relatively mixed. And then it slowly, you know, with school busing and in the 70s got, you know, sort of more and more African-American. So as that happened, it's actually then they stayed and the neighborhood changed.
What's his ethnic background?
He's white from Canada. So, you know, I think he says he identified a lot with black culture because he came from Canada and he felt like sort of an outsider.
Of course.
Yeah. I don't know why. You know, he said he felt like an outsider. He had wool pants and that made him feel really, you know, like an outsider. But you know, from the time I was born, he was pretty much always completely integrated into black culture.
So it wasn't some sudden thing that happened to him?
No, not at all. I mean, I think it happened gradually as the neighborhood changed, you know, so did he a little bit and his friends. And I also think, you know, it had a lot to do with, you know, playing sports. I mean, he was a big football player all through high school, going into, you know, one semester of college. And, you know, he also played basketball. And
many people have memories of their dad trying to act hipper than he really is.
Right.
Did you feel that way about your dad?
No, not at all. I felt like my dad was the coolest, hippest person in the whole entire world. Like, I was the one that felt always like the square. I mean, I was constantly trying to hip it up and, you know, failing miserably. I mean, the book's a lot about just how unbelievably cool he was and how hard it was for me to be not quite a little bit out of step.
My guest is Mishna Wolf. She's author of the memoir, I'm Down. The book is about being raised by her father, who's white, but who considered himself part of black life, black culture. And this was in Seattle. Did he want you, expect you, make you to look and act the way he did?
Well, yeah, I mean, it wasn't that he expected me to look and act the way he did. He just didn't, by the time I was born and growing up, he didn't really even interface that much with white culture. So he just expected me to act what he thought was normal, you know? So we would go to like Black Baptist Church every week. And, you know, I played on an all black basketball team and I went to Boys and Girls Club that was, you know, all African American. And I just was expected to not be weird and fit in, you know, which was, you know, I was the only white kid everywhere. So it was, you know, it was hard to be not weird.
Did you ever get the sense that people, either black people or white people, were laughing at your dad?
Yeah, absolutely. But that didn't come for me until much, much later. I mean, as a really young child, at least at this where the book starts out, I really had no idea that my dad wasn't the coolest person in African-American culture as well as white culture. I mean, he just sort of exuded this, you know, he was a big personality. And as I got older, you know, people sort of, you know, wink, wink, nod, nodded behind his back. But I wasn't privy to that when I was younger.
Did you think of yourself when you were young as a white person living as if you were black, or did you see yourself as just no different from the people in your neighborhood?
No, I mean, I felt like it things. I mean, a lot of what inspired me to write the memoir is these moments where certain things dawned on me, you know, and there was a moment that it really dawned on me that I was white and that was probably not a great thing, you know, at least.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. It hit me one day and very suddenly that, you know, there was something different about me. And it was not something that the other kids necessarily picked up on because we were too young, but it was something that their parents really sort of enforced, or there was a weird vibe around me and some of the other parents.
Mishna Wolf is author of the memoir, I'm Down. How does your father look today? How does he act today?
Well, I mean, my father still looks pretty much the same. He acts, you know, pretty much the same. He's grown in a lot of ways from the person this book is, you know, race and class is the backdrop for sure. But the book is a lot about my relationship with him during a period of both our lives where, you know, he was going through some stuff and I was going through some stuff. So, I mean, he's got a nice wife who's also African-American. He had an African-American wife in the book, and he has his second African-American wife. And, you know, he has an African-American stepson and step-grandson who he's great with, you know. So, you know, he's totally integrated into his neighborhood still, but he's a lot humbler and, you know, a little more defeated than he was at the time in the book.
Looking at you today, you don't look like someone trying to fit into a predominantly black neighborhood.
No, I don't think I do.
How did things change for you and why?
Well, when I was about 7 years old, I got accepted into a program for the highly gifted in Seattle, and it was in across town. I had to take a bus, and it was full of like the richest white kids I've ever met in my entire life. I mean, they had boats, they had ponies. You know, they didn't have to go to the library to use the encyclopedia. They had their own reference materials at home. It was pretty crazy for me. So,
what did they think of you?
They thought I was too ghetto. So. Not only was I too white at home, I was too black in my school. And, you know, and it sort of manifested itself in different ways. Like when I was at home, we would do the dozens to sort of, you know, we called it capping, to sort of assert our superiority over each other. And it was just this banter that went back and forth.
But were you good at it?
I got pretty good at it, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I wasn't the best.
Yeah.
And it's not the most original. I mean, it's not the most original comedic form. A lot of it's borrowed.
It's the Your Mama type stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And there are a lot of recycled ones. So you hear one here, you use it over there. It's not, you know, I mean, there's very few people that write their own.
Do you go back to the old neighborhood?
Yeah, all the time. All the time. But, you know, I mean, I've got to say, like a lot of inner city neighborhoods, it's changed a lot. I mean, it's gentrified. It's, you know, there's now a lot of, you know, young gay and lesbian couples, and you know, a lot more you know, sort of, you know, hippie types and stuff like that in the neighborhood I used to live in.
There have been several memoirs in the last few years that have gotten a lot of publicity because it turned out they were made up or partly made up. The story that you tell in I'm Down is so astonishing. How should people know whether to believe you?
Well, there's pictures.
That's true.
That helps. You know? There's a lot of pictures. I don't know. I mean, it doesn't feel astonishing to me. And a lot of people that write me, I mean, I get a lot of letters from people who grew up in mixed race neighborhoods or were the only black people in an all white school. I have a lot of African American fans. I get a lot of letters from people who were the only white people. I mean, for my generation of kids that grew up after civil rights and after the 70s, this is not astonishing. It's very normal. You know, we grew up in a period where race and class had certainly like mobilized itself a lot. And there was really not the same kind of rules there were before. There wasn't the same kind of order, particularly on the West Coast.
Yeah, there are photos, and I've seen the photos, but I need to ask about the photograph on the cover.
Oh, yeah.
With this girl with this crazy afro.
Yeah,
that must be Photoshop.
This is Photoshop. Yeah, this is not my hair. This is this is what I'm going to call representational.
Yes. What does your dad think about the book?
You know, I think he was, I mean, it's comedic, the book. So I think he was happy of, you know, the lightness of the tone. I don't think I could write a book. I mean, to me, tragedy in writing is when three people are right at the same time. You know, and they're all in conflict with each other. And until I could find everyone's point of view in the book, I wasn't really able to write it. So, you know, I understand where he was coming from and what was going on with him. I understand what was going on with my stepmother during the time a little bit better. And I understand a little bit better, you know, sort of how the changes that I went through during that period. So I think he felt like it was actually more even and balanced than he had expected. And he actually bought 10 copies, like right out of the gate. So it's pretty happy.
Mishner Wolf's memoir is titled I'm Down. You've had a lot of coverage of this, a lot of good reviews. But when I went to the Amazon page for your book, there were a couple of people who didn't like it. And now, for all I know, these are two girls who you knew at school and hated you. And so who knows?
Right.
But the common theme in their complaints was, one thought that your book was somewhat racist, and the other one thought you were stereotyping both black and white people. How do you respond to that?
Well, I don't think they finished the book. I mean, I hate to say it, but, you know, a memoir is about a character arc. So if you don't get to the end of the book, you don't know what the changes were. You know what I mean? It's like you don't have a coming-of-age story if someone doesn't learn anything and their perspective doesn't change. I mean, the point of a coming-of-age story is about a change in perspective. So, you know, I mean, I like I said, you know, I have a lot of African American fans, and you know, it's a pretty well-rounded book if you get to the end.
Mishna Wolf, author of the memoir I'm Down, she's at the Borders in Roseville tomorrow at 1. Mishna Wolf, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a researcher who studies the impact of bacteria in the gut on human health. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Insight is on Facebook at Insight on Capital Public Radio. Monday on Insight, Justice John Paul Stevens will retire after the U.S. Supreme Court wraps up after the summer. His likely replacement is Elena Kagan, a UC Davis law professor who knows both Stevens and Kagan will join us. And later in the week, our guests will include David Harrington, founder of the Kronos Quartet. Jules B., indie pop singer-songwriter from Sacramento, has a new album just out. It's called Songs for the Ravens, and it's her first full-length record. Jules, who plays under the name Sea of Bees, is a versatile musician. She played most of the instruments on Songs for the Ravens. She's in her studio. Jules B., welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
And also with us is John Bocciagalupi, who's a guitarist, plays with Jules, and is also the producer of the album Songs for the Ravens. John, welcome.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Jules, this was your first record, and you took on a lot because you wrote it, you sang it, and you played almost all the instruments. Was that the plan going in, that this would be you?
Yes. It was completely like unexpected, like the whole process of everything. It just naturally all came together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell us how you write your songs.
Usually by experiences or through my feelings, or after, for example, like watching a movie and you're just really touched and you want to get that, just that feeling out. So you find a melody and start from there.
So it starts with a melody?
Yeah.
On what instrument? Do you write on one instrument in particular?
Mainly the acoustic, but pianos once in a while to find a really pretty melody, yeah.
Talking with Jules B., she has a new album out, Songs for the Ravens. You came to Capital Public Radio a few days ago with your band and recorded several songs that are on the album.
Yeah.
And we're going to listen to excerpts from a couple of those. Why don't we listen to one of those right now? Jules, which song would you like us to listen to?
Awesome. How about our... oh, goodness. They're all great to me.
Well, we have Gnomes. Gnomes? How about Gnomes?
Gnomes would be awesome.
Okay, let's listen to Gnomes. That's the song Gnomes, performed by Sea of Bees, recorded at Capital Public Radio a few days ago. Sea of Bees came in, recorded a whole bunch of songs that are on the latest edition of Off Air, which is Capital Public Radio's online music show at smartrockradio.org. Jules, you play under the name Sea of Bees, and that's S-E-A of Bees. Why do you choose that name for your, I wouldn't say your alter ego, but as your musician ego?
Because I was always known as Julie Bee. And I don't know, I always loved the sea. And I thought it would be kind of funny. Like, it was originally like Sea of G's. I was making fun of, you know, I think somebody, and it came out, you know, Sea of G's. And I thought for a name, it would be really nice, Sea of Bees, you know?
And pulling back further into your real name, your name is really Julianne, is it Benziger or Benziger?
Benziger, yeah.
Benziger. So yeah. You abbreviated that to B for, I guess, for convenience.
Yeah. it's hard to say sometimes.
Yes.
Yeah.
The producer of Jules' record is with us, as I've said already, John Bacigalupi. John, what was your approach to working with Jules, who clearly is a very versatile musician with a strong sense of what she wants to do? What does a producer do with someone like that?
Just try and help her get what's in her head onto tape, well, these days, onto a hard drive, and maybe take it a little bit further, hopefully. Yeah. So we would kind of do a demo, work on some arrangements, go into the studio. Most of the record was tracked live with Jules and James Neal playing drums. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the vocals and the initial guitar or piano are just a live take with, you know, no editing or punching in or anything like that. And then we discussed maybe adding some overdubs and whatever Jules had in mind. And then I would kind of suggest some other stuff. And I quickly found out how kind of intuitive and an accomplished musician Jules is.
Jules, having such a strong sense of who you are musically and being so versatile as an instrumentalist, what's it like for you working so closely with such an experienced producer as John Bacigalupi?
It's easy and fun. Like, yeah? There was no there wasn't pressure at all. It was just natural. We'd go into the studio, I'd have an idea what I wanted to do. I'd show him it. We'd lay down a track, and then we just do the basics, and then we'd have fun mixing it. It was enjoyable working with him. It was like pure joy.
Wow.
Yeah, it was good.
John, this is at the studio that you own. Where's that?
The Hangar here in Sacramento.
Yeah.
One of the things that was really neat about this record was throwing instruments at Jules that she'd never played or seen. I mean, on the track Willis, for instance, there's a four-piece mallet arrangement that we kind of came up with.
Mallet? Hammer?
There's a, no, marimba, vibraphone, xylophone, and glockenspiel. And she'd never played any of those instruments. We worked out an arrangement, and she played all those parts in about an hour and a half, just banged the whole thing out really quickly with almost very little punching in or mistakes.
Punching in meaning sort of
like
last minute fixes.
I made a mistake, take me back to the fourth bar and we'll punch in there. So there was very little of that on this record.
Jules, how did you react to being presented with all these instruments?
I was curious always to see what would happen, so I would just do it and see what would happen, and the results were John would think it sounded cool and I'd be like, yeah, you're right, it does sound cool.
You played all these instruments, some of them a little exotic even, but you didn't play the drums. Why not the drums?
I don't know how to play drums that well. I can't keep a rhythm sturdy.
Really?
Straight out, no.
Your rhythm's great.
I'm great at rhythm.
She did all the handheld percussion, which
drums,
is really
like,
hard.
I'd probably play one beat the whole entire album.
You are going to do a song for us here. We do have these band recordings made at Capital Public Radio, but you're also going to do a song for us in the studio, a more stripped-down version with John Bacigalupi playing the guitar. Mm-hmm. Jules, what's the song?
The song is called Strikefoot.
Strikefoot?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, let's hear it then.
Awesome. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. Oh, I'm not afraid to
That was beautiful. In our studio, the song Strike Foot, played by Jules B, a.k.a. Sea of Bees, with guitarist John Bacigalupi. Sea of Bees has a new album called Songs for the Ravens, and there's a record release concert tomorrow night at the Townhouse Lounge in Midtown Sacramento. John Bacigalupi produced the record. Jules, what does that mean, Songs for the Ravens?
Songs for, like, the lonely people, you know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do your songs live? Given that you made this record so much with you playing the instruments, what does that mean for concerts?
I do a lot of solo concerts. And also, sometimes I'll invite my friends to come along and help me out and be, you know, play with me.
Like John Bacigalupi?
Like John Bacigalupi and James Neal and Bryce Gonzalez, who plays bass. I have a lot of close friends in on this.
John, as a producer, does it change the songs when there are other people playing in them as opposed to Jules?
Well, we've been working to put together a 7-piece band for the show tomorrow night.
7-piece
at the Townhouse with all the folks Jules just mentioned, as well as Amber Padgett and Juju and Sam Coe. So we're able to get a lot of the arrangements pretty close to what's on the record. But it works both ways. Like, Jules' solo is different and very cool than Sea of Bees as the band. They both work really well, as a fan of both.
Yeah.
Jules, who else do you like to listen to musically, just for pleasure?
Jeremy Enoch from Sunny Day Real Estate.
Okay.
Yeah, and I've gotten into the Kinks. I never heard them before until this year.
Yeah, and, can't go wrong there.
Yeah.
But on your MySpace page, it says, I guess it's under the genre, Spanish pop, Dutch pop, Chinese pop. What does that refer to?
Well, my friend from the label, Michael Leahy, I think he was thinking because I went to Spain recently for a tour. And then I think he was thinking also because I'm Japanese, a quarter of it. And so I think he wanted to add that in. So the Chinese, you know, and then what was the Dutch pop? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, maybe it increases your search profile. And the record, I know it's available on iTunes. Is there a physical version of it available?
Yeah, absolutely. At the shows that we do, there's vinyls, CDs, and then I think on Amazon.
Yeah,
right,
Amazon.
John?
It's available record stores, Amazon.
Yeah, record stores.
All possible formats are out there.
Dimple Records has it.
The Beat.
The record's called Songs for the Ravens.
Mm-hmm.
It's by Sea of Bees, which is, for the most part, Jules B. And there's a record release concert tomorrow night, Saturday, at the Townhouse Lounge in Midtown Sacramento. Jules B., John Bacigalupi, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you
for having us.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, and this time it really will happen, a researcher who studies the impact of bacteria in the gut on human health. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison, and you can stream Insight live or later at capradio.org/insight. A reminder, you can hear more songs recorded by CFBs at Capital Public Radio Studios at smartrockradio.org. That's the webpage for Off Air, our Capital Public Radio's online music show. Today on Capital Public Radio News, California's unemployment rate falls to 12.4%, but that's still the third highest in the nation. In Nevada, unemployment rises to 14%. That is now the highest in the nation. All that and more on All Things Considered. Bacteria in our gut aren't the most glamorous of the world's creatures, but they do play a key role in our health. A professor who's an expert in researching these microbes talked today at a food health conference at UC Davis. He's Fergus Shanahan, professor and chair of the Department of Medicine and director of the Alimentary Pharmabiotics Center at University College Cork in Ireland. Fergus Shanahan, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
I guess most people don't like to think about the microbes in their gut. Why should we care about these little bugs?
Well, Jeffrey, I'm just one of a growing number of people in this country and also in Europe and around the world that thinks we really should think about them, because we, while they're not essential for life, they do help us survive better. They do protect us against unfriendly bacteria and so-called pathogens in the environment, and they help our digestion as well. They also provide essential nutrients, including certain vitamins. And they protect us in general. They're overall a health asset.
It sounds like you're saying they do more than digest food, that they have a bigger health role to play. Is that right?
That's true. It has been known for about 50 years, Jeffrey, that studies performed in this country and elsewhere, if you raise animals in a germ-free environment, that is, without any bacteria whatsoever, while they will survive, their immune system is very poorly developed, their digestive tract is very poorly developed, and even their response to stress is suboptimal. In other words, it's not ideal. And so the bacteria actually provide a lot for us to engage with our environment and make us generally more robust.
When we feel stress, when we feel fear, anger, all those negative emotions, we tend to have a sort of unpleasant feeling inside of us. Is that in some way connected to the bacteria in our gut?
Not directly. The bacteria help us in terms of developing our stress response, but there are many things that go into making us robust and respond to stress and cope with stress. But what has been shown is that a very extreme stress can actually influence the composition of the bacteria in the gut. And there are quite nice studies, not in humans, but in animals, that show that the bacteria can actually then get across into the bloodstream. So that's not a good situation to be in.
As a researcher, are you studying these bacteria in our gut to help make sure that those microbes can keep doing what they're supposed to do? Or are you looking for something more than that? In other words, something to harness in those microbes that can maybe create pharmaceuticals or something like that?
No, you're correct, Jeffrey. The latter. We are attempting to harness, exploit, mine or bioprospect, if you like, any of those words. We're trying to find out what are the health benefit signals substances that can be mined and then translated into the next generations of drugs, for example, or perhaps something like a food ingredient that can promote health, particularly in young people. So, for example, if you think that most of the drugs we use today were exploited or mined from microbes in the environment, we're looking at the inner environment. We're looking at something much more natural as a source of the next generation of drugs.
My guest is Fergus Shanahan of University College Cork in Ireland. He spoke earlier today at a conference at UC Davis. It's a food health conference, and his topic was mining microbes for mankind. Can you give us a specific example of something that we might learn from these microbes that could yield better pharmaceuticals or better food?
Well, one tangible example is the adverse effect of antibiotics that we're all familiar with nowadays. There are certain superbugs that have emerged. Many people will be familiar with the term MRSA, which is a resistant staphylococcus, but there's also a new bug that's affecting elderly people when they take antibiotics in our hospitals. This is called Clostridium difficile, and it has an ugly name, a difficult name, but this can kill people. And while many of us will survive, the very vulnerable elderly will succumb to this occasionally. And it has been found that one can find novel antibiotics in the gut, with normal bacteria in the gut, produce novel antibiotics that we can mine and use for the next generation of these of new antibiotics for this superbug. Now, we're a long way away from translating this into a drug that you can buy in your pharmacy, but the science, the scientific proof is already there. The proof of principle is already there for this.
I don't think many people grow up thinking, I want to study bacteria in the gut. How did you get into this field of work?
Well, ironically, I got into this field of work in this state. I worked for 10 years at UCLA. And I was asked to teach some of the medical students what was then a fairly unpopular course. And the lecture I was given was to talk about bacteria in the intestine, about which I knew very little. But once I read on this topic and once I was allowed to speak to the students, I knew this was something I was going to spend the rest of my life being involved with. It's just such an exciting area. I'm one of many people. There are a growing body of scientists and clinicians now in this area. I'm not the only one by any means. But it was pure chance that led me to this area.
And do you eat differently? Do you handle stress or anything differently because of what you've learned from studying these bacteria inside of us?
No, but I'm not a very good patient, Jeffrey. I wouldn't be the best at any of these things, so I'm not great at taking my advice. But however, I have seen this kind of work translate into a more caring approach to the elderly, and even the hygiene that we use in our hospitals today against MRSA, and our general appreciation for the power of microbes, both good and bad, has really meant something to me. So in that way, it has certainly changed my approach to daily life.
Yes. Fergus Shanahan is professor and chair of the Department of Medicine and director of the Alimentary Pharmabiotics Centre at University College Cork in Ireland. He spoke earlier today at a conference at UC Davis about food and health. His subject, mining microbes for mankind. Fergus Shanahan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And that's Insight for this week. Insight's theme was written by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Today's associate producers were Lynn Weaver, Sosin Morar, and joining us for this summer, Natalie Rothfels. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard, and Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Thank you for joining us. At Insight, we have one goal.
That's an interesting... I've never been asked that question before.
Good. Very good question.
That is such a good question.
To get the answers you want to hear.
That is such a great question.
That's a really good question.
From scientists, lawmakers, artists, interesting people of every stripe.
Boy, you have a really uncorked Pandora's box with that with that question.
I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Monday morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.